Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, committed to conservation and careful management of the state's forests to make them more resilient and better habitats for wildlife. Choosewood.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. For many of us living in the landlocked Midwest, the ocean most likely comes to mind during winter, especially those cold, dark days when fantasies about a beachy escape are both reprieve and torture at the same time. But our connection to marine waters goes much deeper than vacation dream fodder. What we do here has a serious impact on those waters and all the life they support. Ocean conservationist and Monterey Bay Aquarium Executive Director Julie Packard knows this very well, and she wants us to know it too. And we're lucky to have her in studio to talk with us about that while she's in town to receive an award from the Whitney R. Harris World Ecology Center at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Julie, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you.
So before we get into the hows and whys, there's that important connection between the Midwest and the ocean. Let's talk first about the Monterey Bay Aquarium, because that's where your work began. Now, for those who've never been, myself included, what do visitors at the Monterey Bay Aquarium see, hear, and feel?
Well, so I do hope many of your listeners have been to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, but if not, encourage them to venture west. So we are located on Monterey Bay, which is in Central California, and the inspiration for our aquarium was really the place where we are and the remarkable biodiversity along the Central California coast. So the aquarium was founded by members of the Dave and Lucille Packard Foundation, and we're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. We get about 2 million visitors a year, and what we try to provide is an experience that takes you underwater on a tour of the habitats and the remarkable ocean life that's right offshore of our West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, it differs from other aquariums in several ways. You've just mentioned being right off the coast there. It's an ocean front. But another way is that it has evolved over time, moving from a focus on experience and awareness to advocacy for action. And its mission today is to inspire conservation of the ocean. Julie, what makes that more than merely interesting, but rather, you know, vital or critical?
Well, of course, I think society, including scientists like myself, used to think of the ocean as so vast we couldn't possibly have an impact on it, and we treated it as such. And really, just over the past several decades, quarter century and more, we've realized, you know, that the ocean is a living ecosystem, that the scale of human impact of our activities is really causing a lot of damage, and we need to attend to that, we need to learn about it, and we need to do everything we can to reverse it. And so with the aquarium, yes, as our mission began really as a place of public awareness and running education programs and doing some basic science, it's really evolved where, you know, we consider ourselves a conservation organization, and the primary goal is to connect people with how they can get involved with making positive change. And also, of course, we have our own teams we've built to be working on the ground in Washington and beyond to make that change.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are a founder and the executive director of the Monterey Bay Aquarium. But you are a triple threat or power in that you are also a scientist. How has your perspective as a conservation scientist shaped the way you approach your role leading the aquarium?
Well, it's interesting. The aquarium was founded by a group of scientists, and, you know, we all have our own path to our careers, and I found for those who are really committed to conservation, you know, a lot of us spent time outdoors and experienced time outdoors, experienced connection with nature. And that certainly was true for me. I grew up in what used to be pretty rural California. Today it's Silicon Valley and is definitely not rural. But I witnessed, I think at a very impressionable age, a huge transformation of land conversion and loss of the magical diversity that we have in California that I grew up as a child treasuring so much. Mm-hmm. And so my interest, I always say, I think of the nature that we need to protect and restore as all encompassing. And so I'm actually not an ocean person from my start.
Right.
I kind of ventured into it because it's all connected. Mm-hmm. And the environmental movement has come so far, starting, you know, pretty much in the 70s, in building awareness and action around terrestrial environments. But really, we're just catching up in terms of the ocean, and we need to think of it all together. And the ocean, of course, we now, over the past few decades, you know, we can see actual changes from human impact. So mm-hmm. scientists, even that used to be just discovering new species, and I mean, there's so much we don't know about the ocean.
Yes.
It's so vast that there's a lot of really cool discovery science to still go on. But pretty much everyone also is, and generally this is true with students at all the universities, including here now, they want to make an impact mm-hmm. and connect the science that they're doing to some outcome that's going to make the world a better place.
Right. Julie, was the evolution of the aquarium and all that you've described, you know, that evolution into an institution that is dedicated to conservation, was that a natural outgrowth of what you and fellow scientists were finding? Or was there like some other way that that happened?
Well, I, as the leader over, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. So as the executive director over all that time, and because my passion, I was always driven by conservation action and environmental science and the public, the need to motivate the public first and foremost. So of course, like with any institution, a lot has to do with leadership. So a lot of that came from me pressing on the topic and the cause. But we did, we updated our mission statement in the late 90s. And one of the really critical things that kind of had us take a big step in terms of not only informing but engaging action on behalf of our public was when we did an exhibit about the global fisheries crisis. It was called Fishing for Solutions, mm-hmm. and it talked about all the problems going on in the global fishing industry. And from that, we decided we needed to get our restaurant menu in order vis-a-vis sustainable seafood. Mm-hmm. And from that, we launched our Seafood Watch program, which is all about building consumer awareness for sustainable seafood. So I would say, you know, once we realized that thing just took off, and we realized, you know, the power of our brand that we had evolved over time, and consumer interest and media interest, and the lack of knowledge among all of us about what goes on out there, mm-hmm. whether it's for fish or for people in the fishing industry or the seafood processing industry, all of that, it generated a lot of interest. So we were like, yeah, we got to fire up and really move in that direction big time.
Right. We are going to return to that. But I want to make sure that we get to something we've been teasing about this segment, which is sort of a get to the facts conversation mm-hmm. about the Midwest.
Yes.
And its role in supporting ocean health. Yes. So what is it that a science says about the role we landlocked folks have to play in ocean conservation?
Yes, that is obviously a really important question that all of us working on the coast and working in ocean conservation are always thinking about, you know, the best way to message it. What is the most clear connection? I mean, obviously, in terms of those that are, the impact of human activities in the Midwestern states, of course, people probably are aware of, you know, all of the agricultural impacts and nutrient runoff and the dead zones and the Gulf and all of that. That is sort of a front and center implication, but as you say, if you don't live there, you're not going to see it.
Right.
And so I think, the one sort of mother of all conservation threats, of course, is global climate change, mm-hmm. and turning that around. And so I really try to focus on that, because all of us, every single one of us, has an impact on, our ability to make progress on that. And of course, that does manifest in manifests in people's lives, whether it's the crazy weather that we've been having,
or the
rising temperatures. And more and more, scientists are telling us that, this is no surprise. The ocean is a driving piece of our climate system. And having a healthy ocean is our best defense against damaging climate change. The oceans have absorbed 90% of the heat produced since the Industrial Revolution mm-hmm. out of our atmosphere. That's huge. And they absorb a huge amount of CO2, the plant life in the ocean, huge amount of CO2. And so that service, that requires a living ocean, not a dead ocean. That's kind of putting it in sort of a crass way. But so all of us have a stake. Our lives depend on a living, healthy ocean. Now, we always can use more help in how to message that in a way that it's really meaningful. But the other way in which people, and this does kind of link back to the seafood question, some of the issues that we're working on from consumer awareness affect everyone living in this country and do have a big impact. That we can talk more about the sustainable
yes.
seafood
mm-hmm.
aspect and all the seafood we consume and how to make that happen in a better way. But also, global plastic pollution is something that we've been really engaged with, and every one of us, is part of that, can be part of that solution
right.
as well.
And that's a great point to stop on. We're going to take a very quick break here, but we will pick up on that point when we return. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, committed to conservation and careful management of the state's forests to make them more resilient and better habitats for wildlife. Choosewood.com.
Welcome back. Before the break, we were talking about the role Midwesterners play in ocean conservation and a little bit about the way that you approach getting people who don't live anywhere near an ocean to see themselves as integral to conservation efforts. And you touched upon both plastic waste and some things that pertain to food. Let's start with the plastic waste first, because earlier today, St. Louis City SC, that's our Major League Soccer team here, sent out a notification about the opportunity to buy the Adidas One Planet pre-match jersey that's made from recycled ocean plastics. Julie, how much do things like this matter when it comes to raising awareness and some support for ocean conservation?
That example, I would say, it's a great example of raising awareness. Love that part. But creating things from recycled ocean plastic is, it's not going to solve the problem. So while I applaud it, we're actually working to get away from that approach somewhat in our stores and in our retail operations at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And really, when it comes to plastic pollution, the U.S. is a big factor in that. And we're the biggest producer of plastic. We supply the world with a lot of plastic. And the solution needs to happen by, reducing it at the source.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I think the public, it was a big eye-opener when news got out that, all this plastic we are quote-unquote recycling, it's being shipped to China and, they don't want it anymore, never mind whether it actually was being recycled and repurposed. It's very hard to actually repurpose, recycle and repurpose plastic at scale. And really, the solution everyone wants to be moving toward is let's reduce the production and use of the single-use plastic. Obviously, plastic is an incredibly valuable material for biomedical and a lot of other purposes.
Right.
But and also really the all of these alternatives that you know people are developing. That's going to be a long road. So a lot of exciting work is happening right now to move forward on this problem. The main thing that actually our team at the aquarium is involved with is this UN Global Plastic Treaty, which is supposed to be it's aiming toward a binding agreement among nations to end global plastic pollution by 2040, I think the date is. And it's on a very accelerated time frame.
Sure.
To get this treaty together just in, I think it's 3 years, and hopefully have an agreement by next year.
Right. So this really then is not so much about what individuals are doing. It's got to go to that policy level that governments are making policies and then enforcing whatever they have in place.
I mean, that's the case, but it is about what individuals are doing and their awareness, because, you know, most policy change in the U.S. starts at the local and then state level. And so you see in a lot of communities, people have, you know, banned use of plastic straws or plastic bags, and even up at the state level. And California actually just passed a very progressive law that really drives, it's going to require what's called extended producer responsibility, meaning the companies that are selling single-use plastic are going to be responsible for it being recycled, which is going to drive them to just quit producing and using so much of it and moving back to, you know, bottle deposit programs and that sort of thing. So it matters. And you know, I feel like conservation change, it takes action at all levels. And when you have schools, you know, or kids encouraging their parents to, you know, hey, let's keep track of how much plastic waste our family creates in a week. It's really shocking when you see it. And there are programs where, hey, let's take a pledge to try to go plastic free as much as we can over a month. And if we all did that, life would be fine. And we could, we could have an impact.
Right.
And also just demonstrate, it just drive a market for alternatives. That's always a big piece too. What's there for us to buy is what we buy.
Right. And one of the things that we buy is food. We said we're going to come back to the Seafood Watch program that came out of the Monterey Bay Aquarium. St. Louis is big on food. I don't know if you've been here long enough to kind of get a sense of that. What kind of impact does making better choices around that, around the food that we eat, have sort of on that individual diner level, and then also on the level of the restaurateur or the food service provider?
I think when it comes to seafood, the consumer voice has the opportunity to make a lot of impact, and it is making impact. And the thing about seafood that's unique when you think about it is it's the last wild food that we are catching and eating on a commercial level. You know, everything else is cultivated, I mean, in developed countries like the U.S. So it's just the thing about fishing, I mean, it can be done sustainably if it's, you know, you're not harvesting too much fish, and if it's not using damaging methods, they're damaging to the seafloor or the habitat, and if it's not having a huge bycatch problem, meaning all the non-targeted species that are, like, sucked up in our giant nets. And it's really about the industrial scale that fishing has come to, that's the fishing industry is using, and our you know, we're really good at developing technology to get more efficient at extracting things. So the consumer voice, our Seafood Watch program that we began at the aquarium, really started with let's define like what would sustainable fishing look like, and then evaluate all the seafood items that are coming into the U.S. market. And because we're a huge market for seafood. I mean, everyone mm-hmm. would like to think, oh, it's, you know, Japan or China, you know, some place that you think more is a seafood,
more of a cuisine,
you know, more of a cultural underpinning for seafood. And here in the U.S., we don't have that so much, but we are a big consumer. And the Seafood Watch program has, you know, by driving consumer demand, then it's driven, and including enlisting a lot of restaurateurs and celebrity chefs to be talking about it
right.
and providing alternatives. I mean, I love seafood. You know, I'm sorry, a lot of people are saying, oh, we should all be, I'd be lighter on the planet if I became a vegan. But,
right.
you know, we're, and there are a lot of people who make their livelihoods in the seafood, you know, realm. And so it can be done sustainably. We can enjoy wild-caught seafood, but we need to do it in a better way. And we are turning things around in U.S. waters. Things are recovering in much better shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are definitely, it's a positive story. The other element that's really growing very fast is aquaculture. And so farm seafood has a
yes.
lot of its own issues. And we're working, again, to define sustainability standards and work with some of those enterprises to reduce their antibiotic use and mm-hmm. other things that need to change.
Yeah. We've actually talked on this program about a local shrimp farm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So as far as aquaculture goes, that is definitely happening here in the Midwest as well.
Yeah. Well, and a shrimp farm here is, I mean, maybe I'm speaking out of school because I'm not that familiar with inland aquaculture, but a shrimp farm here likely, if you have water, it's likely to be pretty benign, you mm-hmm. know, on the natural environment.
Right.
Most of the shrimp we import here, and most of the shrimp Americans eat is imported, and it's imported from nations around the world that are doing shrimp farming often in too intensive a way, or they've cut down mangrove forests mm-hmm. to make for that, and it's a really important source of livelihood. And so, and actually we're working in Vietnam in a big area of the Mekong Delta where we're working with several thousand shrimp farmers who want to get their product up to a Seafood Watch Best Choice rating.
Okay.
And we're giving them the tools and helping them get there, which is great. So then they'll get into the U.S. market. The big retailers in the U.S., the Walmarts, the Costcos, like Safeway, 80% of them have made a time-bound commitment to source only sustainable seafood. So we've created a market through this movement.
Right.
And so now the world can, you know, respond.
Right. And that brings up something that I wanted to make sure that we touched on, because the approach that you take to advocating for ocean conservation, it really strikes me as being realistic and humanistic at the same time. So, you know, you're not making demands of people or even companies that could be extreme, like you had mentioned, like just become vegan or, you know, fishing needs to stop. I mean, beyond the pragmatics of that, why is that an approach that you've taken to this ocean conservation work?
That's a really great question, and you're very observant, you know, to be commenting on that. I would say it's probably kind of rooted in, I mean, I'm a very practical person. My father was a very successful businessman. He grew up in rural Colorado and loved land conservation and was all about conservation, but also, you know, in a practical way. And, you know, working landscapes are important. They need to continue. So I think that's sort of the ethos that I, you know, grew up in and embraced. And, you know, I believe we need all the approaches there. I think of it like it's an ecosystem of all the nonprofit advocacy organizations. You've got ones that are boycotting and protesting, and you've got ones that are like really working closely with business. But I just believe to make change on these issues, you have to develop a trusting, positive relationship with business, because they're the ones that are, you know, if you can help them change and still be successful, you'll get there. Otherwise, I mean, business needs to continue. People need jobs. We need to eat. I mean, I'm just practical about
it. Yeah, yeah. So stories are something that we like to talk about on this show. What are some of the stories, Julie, that you share that demonstrate the positive impact people can make by choosing to do things a little bit differently?
Well, I think, I mean, that's, I have many examples, you know. I would say, I mean, a lot of this policy change that I've spoken of where we have, you know, a state like California passing a bill to, you know, ban, you know, single-use plastic moving forward, all of those victories started with a story, really, and a kind of escalating from stories being spread around. So that example, what comes to mind is, you know, high school students lobbying, you know, the little town of Carmel to, like, quit using single-use plastic or, you know, drop plastic straws. And again, you know, plastic straws, getting rid of plastic straws is not going to save the world by any means. But that's where it starts. I think the voices, youth voices, I think are so, and we certainly see that with climate change, are very powerful. And, you know, we have families coming to the aquarium that I remember one of the most powerful moments for me was, you know, walking out in her deck and opening the door for a woman and her daughter. And she was like, my daughter's never seen the ocean. Mm-hmm. And this kid could be living 20 minutes away in the Central Valley or an agricultural community.
Right.
I mean, there's a massive socioeconomic divide going on in our country, and I think especially in California. So those stories are really impactful and, you know, just raising awareness person by person.
Yeah. So as we wrap here, I mean, there's so much work that you do. Some of it is going to include, you know, traveling to the UN Global Plastics Treaty negotiations in Ottawa, Canada, later this month. What is it that you do, though, when the work is sort of tiring you out, and going back to the beginning, where or what is your Monterey Bay Aquarium sort of happy place for refilling your energy or your inspiration tank?
Yeah, we all need that, especially in these times, right? For me, I love hanging out with our team members who are working with animals. And I love walking out in the building and someone will tell me a story of some, I don't even know what, you know, a juvenile sea bass or something that they just got and that are like so excited to see it. And just the excitement of connecting with animals and the empathy and love of animals and of nature that we all share, that gives me... That's refreshing. And of course, it's such a privilege to be able to go out in the aquarium when it's packed with people. I mean, we could have 10,000 people on a summer day and just all these families just having a great time. And each of them is interpreting their experience in a completely different way. And that's fine. That's fine.
Julie, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This episode was produced by Elaine Shaw. Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association. Missouri produces wood pallets, railroad ties, white oak barrels, hardwood floors, and more. Details on the variety of products made in the state are at choosewood.com.